I'd like to make a very warm welcome to the Conference on Science and Sustainability in Early Childhood Education. We have been looking so very much forward to sharing knowledge about science, sustainability, mathematics, and nature within the field of early childhood education.
At this year's Nevada Conference, researchers and educators from around the world gather to explore one big question. How can science and sustainability come alive in early childhood education? The answers aren't simple. They involve care, curiosity, and sometimes different perspectives. My name is Mille Sjögren. I spoke with three international researchers at the Nevada Conference, each offering their own lens on what it means to learn with the world, not just about it. The Nevada Project looks at how children's engagement with the world through science, mathematics, nature, and sustainability can open new ways of understanding. At this conference, international researchers were invited to contribute their perspectives to that wider dialogue. To begin, we asked each researcher, what do we actually know about creating science-based learning environments for children? What's important for educators to understand right now? First, we hear from Professor Marilyn Fleer at Monash University in Australia. Her research explores how imagination and play can open a child's understanding of scientific ideas.
It's really important for children in the early childhood period, but also in the school sector, to have rich experience of science learning. Because in a context of sustainability and people worrying about what's going to happen in the future, it's good to create really nice conditions for children not to be worrying, but to have the ability to know how to act and with agency. And this means that we can create conditions for them that that draws on different evidence-based practices for teachers to use. And so one example is the work that I've been leading in Australia called A Conceptual Play World. And the Conceptual Play World gives five very nice characteristics to educators to create these nice conditions for children's learning of science. And the first one is that they begin their planning by thinking about a really engaging a story, something that's got lots of drama in it and it's emotionally connects with them. So, for example, in the story of Charlotte's Web, where Wilbur the pig is the runt of the litter, the problem is that Fern worries about Wilbur being slaughtered for Christmas dinner. This is really emotionally engaging for children, but it also creates the possibility for some rich learning about, well, what do you do? In this model, we always have an authentic problem that the children will solve. So in the example that I'm giving, of course, you know, Wilbur's going to be slaughtered, so they want to save him. So how are they going to save Wilbur? And so the children are motivated with this play problem. So that's from the child's perspective, because as they learn about pigs and about the runt of the litter and how to care for a pig and what might be a nice environment for the pig to be in the pigsty, then what we see is that the children become oriented to knowing how to care for Wilbur, and also feeling agentic, that they have some science knowledge that they develop along the way. And then the last characteristic is where the teachers plan their role. So they're going to be a play partner with the children, which is so different to being the formal teacher, giving information and directing. This model gives these very nice playful conditions, but conditions that actually collectively orient the children to actually have some really deep knowledge of science, but the children are just enjoying this beautiful experience of being on Wilbur's farm and helping Wilbur survive.
Next, we travel to the US to Professor Christine McWane from Tufts University. Her research focused on how teachers and families build strong learning relationships and how that connection supports children's curiosity.
So my work being centered in the United States, in urban areas in particular, mm-hmm. means that preschool classrooms are incredibly multicultural. And so the programs that I tend to work with might have students representing as many as 20 different languages in them. And so one of the most important things that we've found in our work is that understanding that children come from diverse family backgrounds and cultural communities is key for teachers who are trying to connect any kind of learning, but science learning included, mm-hmm. to be able to build on children's familiar knowledge. Mm-hmm. And children can tell us a lot about their familiar knowledge themselves, but another really important way to connect to that familiar knowledge is to connect to their families. And so a lot of my work has been centered on how do we create stronger connections between teachers and families. I also have, I believe this to be true, but I've also seen it to be true through our intervention work, mm-hmm. is when teachers feel supported themselves, when they feel that they're part of a community, they are able to better connect with children. And they have the, I don't know, if you will, the psychological space when they feel that kind of support from their leadership, from each other, from other people that they might be working with, from the families in their classroom. They have the energy, the passion, the curiosity to connect with children in really meaningful ways, mm-hmm. when they're not worried about all the other things that teachers have to worry about.
For McWane, strong relationships between adults are what allow curiosity to thrive in children. And finally, to Canada, where Professor Sean Blenkinsop works with what he calls wild pedagogies, learning what happens not only in nature, but with nature.
Creating good learning environments, there's a bunch of things that go on. I'll just name a few. One, you want them to be diverse, robust, lots of possibilities, lots of things going on, lots of things to encounter, lots of things to explore, kind of imaginatively rich, as it were. That's super helpful. Two, it's fun to have places that are super rich in terms of possibility of encounter as well. Right? So a lot of the work that I do is in outdoor schools. So they're public schools that don't have buildings and happen outside.
Okay.
Which then means that, like, you're not just encountering teacher, desk, classroom. You're also encountering, like, the local dog walker comes walking through, right? Or the salmon come cruising up the stream, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that kind of rich encounter. And that includes, like, encountering the dead salmon, right? Or whatever it might be. So you get these kind of much more diverse kind mm-hmm. of encounter possibilities. Mm-hmm. I tend to think about the most important thing is that we're in a time of crisis, right?
Yeah.
Environmentally, for sure. But I also think there's like a deep social justice crisis as well, right? So we're in this world of change. And so I think if education is actually going to help respond to that kind of crisis, then education has to change as well, right? So what are the tools we need to give kids to respond to these crises? Like, how can they deal with risk? What's it like to live in uncertainty, right? How do you build communities? How do you build alliances so you can respond to these kinds of changes? Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that I think about. There's one school that's outside all the time, has no building whatsoever, mm-hmm. and the other four do various levels of outside mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And those schools think about things slightly differently. Some of them prioritize kind of nature as co-teacher, so it's a kind of decentering of the human teacher and kind of trying to build these spaces where you think about knowledge differently, where students have more chance to explore and encounter the natural world as an actual co-teacher. So you're kind of undercutting particular anthropocentric values and that kind of stuff. How do the kids respond? Our experience is they really like it, right? Partially because they're heard, partially because those outdoor environments are richer. So there's more things to engage with, but also more supports for them in a particular kind of way. Canada has more and more complex kids. I don't know how you talk about them in Denmark,
it's
right?
It's the same year, I think.
Right? And some of it is, right? This is anxiety. This is sort of mental health stuff. These are like realities of the culture as well, kind of thing. And the natural spaces actually provide places where kids can co-regulate, where they can self-regulate, right? Kids who have particular needs can slide next to a river, provides a particular kind of white noise. Those kinds of things are happening. I think it's just, they're just richer environments.
But knowing what matters is only one part of the story. Turning research into real practice, in busy classrooms, in real lives, comes with its own challenges and dilemmas. We begin with Professor Marilyn Fleer and the practical side. What makes it hard for teachers in real early childhood settings?
So the biggest challenge that we find from our research has been around what knowledge do we really want the children to become oriented to? And so teachers, they have a curriculum, they can, and if it's a very broad curriculum, well, what might be the science concept? So ecosystem can be a concept that we might think about for later in school, but actually children, when they interact in the environment, they are forming some sort of conception or understanding of an ecosystem, because if they're looking for something, they're curious to look at all the insects in the environment. If they're thinking, well, where does the insect live? So you start to explore the habitat, but to really understand habitat, what's the food source, and then what structure of the insect interacts with that, and how does that insect, if we change the ecosystem, mm-hmm. what impact that has. So this is a dynamic way of thinking about concept development, and I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges. So rather than taking a curriculum and saying, okay, we're going to teach this, mm-hmm. it's thinking through, okay, what is the fundamental core knowledge here that we're going to orient the children towards? And then the other side of that is, well, what's the authentic problem that the children will want to solve in order to build that knowledge?
And when we shift from practice to research, the challenges look different. Professor Christine McWane points to one of the biggest research challenges, how knowledge actually moves into practice.
Finding ways to include all children, so creating inclusive classrooms, which also speaks to culturally inclusive classrooms, I feel like is probably one of the biggest challenges. And with that, a big challenge is creating meaningful and accessible ways for teachers to connect to children's families and to understand their out-of-school experiences so they can build on those in the classroom. We don't always have a lot of really concrete ways to help teachers do that. And so if they don't come by that naturally, it can be a very big challenge in connecting with individual children.
And Sean Blekingsop adds another layer, a cultural one.
Since I think about part of the ways in which I think about my work in terms of creating learning environments is creating learning environments that allow the possibility for this kind of deeper cultural change conversation. So in some ways, the biggest challenges are the culture, as it were, right? And actually that's less manifest in 2-year-olds than it is in the 2-year-olds' human teachers, than it is in the 2-year-olds' parents and caregivers, than it is in the community around the school, right? So it's amazing how much of the work that I do is actually about educating community to allow the space for this kind of education to happen underneath.
And Marilyn Flair reminds us that it's not only what children learn, but how they come to understand it.
The biggest challenge for working with teachers who work with young children is convincing them that it's okay to learn concepts, deep, meaningful concepts, because when it's an experiential program, and which is incredibly valuable and important, but also children need more than that, because if they're experiencing something, they can be oriented. If we as adults orient them towards certain things, that will help them develop this understanding, this conceptual understanding of their world, like an ecosystem, then it's very empowering for children. And I think this is the big challenge, because we often follow children's interests, but there are many children with many interests. Mm. So this is really hard for teachers. Because how deep can you go with orienting children to a range of concepts? And I think this sets up challenges for us as researchers to have interventions that persuade teachers that that it's okay to have deep concepts planned for.
Let's end by looking ahead. What keeps these researchers curious right now? We begin with Christine McWane, who reflects on the political climate in the US and why a conference like Nevada feels like a breath of fresh air.
The political context in the US right now is such that people are even asking the question of, is climate change real? So to come to a conference.
I love your laugh again.
I mean, it's a coping mechanism.
Okay. Yeah,
you have to laugh.
Yes.
You know, it's just a wonderful experience to be part of a group that the base foundation of the work today accepts that as a reality. So I would love to see more of that in U.S. schools. It is a peripheral part of what students learn, and it tends to happen in later grades. So to have it be present in early childhood. And you see, even in the urban programs that I work in, children can connect with the nature around them. They don't have to go out into the forest to do that. It's right there. And so our teachers have been really creative in how they help students to observe and interact with the neighborhood nature, the nature that's right there in their neighborhood.
And for Marilyn Flair, the big question right now is how we understand learning and play, not just learning through play.
I've been really interested in this this idea that if we're looking at the relationship between play and learning, then rather than talking about play as children learning through play, it's actually about learning in play. And this is a real shift. And so my work at the moment has been around now taking all of this empirical material that I've generated to develop a theoretical model that explains learning in play. Mm. Not learning through play as a practice, but learning in play as a theoretical model.
And finally, Sean Blekingsop, who stays curious about development and what it means to remain connected to the natural world.
Right now, if I think seriously about the theories of development that we have to work with in education, all of them are aiming towards a kind of detached individual, right? That's what we think is a kind of, where we're aiming for in terms of, and they can be really thoughtful, they can be citizen aware, they can be those kinds of things. But that's not exactly what I think we really want to aim for. We want to aim for a sort of more relationally engaged set of beings at that point in time. Mm. And I don't really know what that developmental model might look like. Like I genuinely don't know what like Raven would look like as an adult.
Yeah.
If she was in a context that valued that, honored that, thought that was important.
And he illustrates that curiosity with the story of a 4-year-old girl, Raven.
So it's a grade 4 girl. She's chosen the name Raven, right? Mm-hmm. And in the research encounters with Raven, Raven starts to talk about having conversations with the natural world, right? That she's in conversation with the natural world and the natural world is talking to her. Mm. Right? And initially it's like, oh, that's a kind of intriguing metaphor, right? But it's not a metaphor. And Raven's not the only one. We've had lots of kids who do this. And it's like, that opens up this really intriguing space when you think about how are we going to respond to the climate change crisis? How are we going to respond to the, well, we've got kids who are in deep relationship with the natural world, right? Maybe we should ask them. Mm.
Right. What are we going to do?
Exactly. Yeah, maybe they have an idea. Yeah. Tell us what the trees are thinking about this kind of stuff. So that kind of thing has been spectacular. And that required leaving space for Raven to build those relationships, right? And a willingness to not dismiss Raven's experience, if that makes any sense.
Because
it would be really easy to go, oh, that's nice.
Sure.
You have an imaginary friend, right? Eventually you grow up. I think that's exactly what's happened, right? Culturally, we're pushed to close that down.
Yeah.
And then the next research question is, what would an adult look like who didn't have to close that down?
And Blekingsop leaves us with a reminder, maybe the biggest lesson is not to teach more, but to listen more. The Nevada Project continues to explore these questions, not to find final answers, but to keep the dialogue alive. Because science, sustainability, and childhood are all living processes shaped by curiosity, care, and conversation. Thank you for listening to this podcast. My name is Mille Sjögren, and you can find all the other podcasts on nevada.dk.